On Sunday morning, April 28th, 2002, I was able to talk with Hal Crowther, sitting on the porch of the cabin he owns with his wife, the novelist Lee Smith, in the mountains of North Carolina. Hal and Lee had invited a gathering of friends and family to join them there and to attend Merlefest, the annual bluegrass and acoustic music festival honoring the late Merle Watson and his father Doc Watson, which was being held not far away in Wilkesboro. I've spent some time in Williamstown, and I've poked around at Williams College. I have some friends who worked there, and I know that was part of your preparation for a life in writing. Was there anything special about the Williams experience that was remarkable or especially helpful or important?
I think it confirmed my sense of myself as an outsider. You know, as a kid from a very small town, you know, when I didn't live anywhere a long, long time, but the town where I'd come to college from college from was a town in the Appalachians, about 800 people, and you know, there I was with, you know, the children of the very privileged, mostly, and I think the first thing I tried to do was fit in the best I could, you know, sort of remember which loafers to wear and that sort of thing, and then I realized that was demeaning. And I decided instead to sort of play Little Abner and see how that worked, you know, look as country as I possibly could. And, you know, a lot of the people, I mean, they talk about these places being full of snobs and rejection and so on. Williams is a small school where everybody knows everyone else. It's sort of not like Harvard or Princeton where everyone is sort of immediately segregated into the, you know, the good eating houses and the middle ones and the poor ones. And so everybody knows everyone else. So it's not a place where I think people are crushed by snobbery, but you're always aware, you know, that you're surrounded by the children of senators and CEOs and so on. And although I didn't come up in college with a real strong class sense or class animosity, I came up with a confirmed sense, which I'd already had, I think, of being an outsider. And it started in the town where I lived, because of course my parents were educated, they were teachers, and we were in a place where almost no one had gone to college. And my parents weren't from there, I had no kin there, so I was an outsider already. You know, and if you did well in school, you were an outsider. And sports was the only way in, which I pursued almost to, you know, to the destruction of all my joints, which I'm suffering now. But I desperately, because like I was a big kid, tried to fit in the only way I knew how, which is by sacrificing my body, right? And I was already feeling like an outsider, and Williams definitely put more of that into me. I think my idol when I was there was a guy named Red Fred Schumann, who was a political science professor who had been investigated by McCarthy, and everybody knew that Red Fred was one of the main targets of the McCarthy committee, and they, Williams College had voted, I think, by one vote to keep him, but he was the symbol of dissent and outsiderhood and so on, and I sort of watched him, you know, walk around the campus and said, someday I'd like to be like that.
In your article, you raise the subject of social class. You address that quite directly. And you mentioned that's a subject we usually refuse to take up in this country. I'm reminded that Paul Fussell has taken up that topic in his book, Class, A Guide Through the American Status System, where, among other things, he indicates that there are only two classes that wish to remain invisible in American society, the very rich and the very poor. But meanwhile, everyone else prefers to offer only mute evidence of their class status, and otherwise it's a matter that Americans just don't talk about much.
Well, the great myth, you know, that every man can be president, every man can be king, and of course it's not true, but it's true, it's not true for different reason. In Europe it's definitely a caste system that, you know, that's very hard to overcome, particularly in England where so many of us our ancestors came from. But in this country, It's technically true, you know, and it's the great myth that everybody clings to. And it's the reason that right-wing politics do so well in this country, because there's this impression that everybody can be the CEO, everybody can be the U.S. Senator, so there's no reason why he should identify with losers and people who are going to be on the bottom of the barrel. There's no reason that he should vote for politicians that are going to try to help the, you know, the poor and the disadvantaged. And I think that's the great weakness, maybe, of, you know, the American electorate, is that it believes profoundly in this upward mobile myth, and it's manipulated, of course, by cynical people.
Absolutely. I've seen that over and over again. You also prepared for your career at the School of Journalism at Columbia, correct? I wonder, how did that confirm you in or even turn you aside from your goals?
It was almost like a toss of a coin. You know, I'd had lawyers in my family, and I applied to UVA Law School, and I applied to, you might be able to tell from the way I write, I also applied to Divinity School. Not because I was, you know, a member of any particular church, but because I was really interested in religious questions and spirituality and so on. And I could see myself in a pulpit, I guess. And I sort of taught, and of course, I was an English student, graduated, my degree was in English literature. So I also considered graduate school in English. And I just didn't know, you know, back in those days, you didn't start choosing a career when you were a freshman, particularly not at a liberal arts school like Williams. And basically, unfortunately, at that stage in my life, I graduated young, I was 21, I guess, I didn't have any real notion, and I was a little lazy. And someone told me that law school was real hard and real boring, and, you know, that English graduate school, particularly at the places that I had applied, was really hard. And I just said, well, you know, journalism school, you know, I bet there are a lot of people there that are kind of slow. And lo and behold, I was right. But, you know, it's a very good journalism school. But a journalism school is another one of those, you know, vocational schools that's been elevated, you know, to the level of academia, which really shouldn't be. I mean, this will get me in trouble, but I really think that it's true. I think that the difference between a real journalist and a non-journalist has nothing to do with formal education. I mean, journalism is a gift and an instinct. I mean, I'm not saying that journalists are schmucks and journalism's not important. I'm just saying that things that are passed on from, you know, from one to the other aren't the main things that make a good journalist. I think the only really positive thing about going to Columbia Journalism, and my attitude there was not good, and I don't want to get into that, but the trouble with me is, you know, as many people who read my essays may already have figured out, is that I will pretty much soon tell you what I think, you know. I encountered some great people there. I had a class with Jimmy Breslin and the late Dick Schaap and you know, some of these wonderful New York newspaper characters. And that was life educational, tremendously so. I mean, Breslin had a class where half the time Breslin didn't show up, but he'd send one of his flunkies, you know, some bookie or something, some guy, a member of his group, of his entourage would show up. A guy named Fat Thomas, actually he's a 400-pound bookie, used to come and say, well, Jimmy's in Brooklyn, you know, and there's a fire out there, you guys. And, you know, we're going to go out there, we're going to catch a fire, and we're going to have a few brews, you know, and that, the whole class would be, you know, on the subway, you know. It was very educational, but not in the sense of maybe probably of learning, you know, how to write journalism or how to think journalism even. But in New York, you got to meet a lot of the people who would and could hire you, which back in the 60s, when jobs were plentiful, turned out well for me.
You know, you're talking about another aspect of the background you feel that you've acquired, by accident perhaps, that helped lay the foundation for the writer you've become. Do you have any other sort of work experiences or other experiences of that nature which you feel also shaped the writer you would become?
Well, I'll get back to the work thing, but I think the thing that mainly makes me, you know, the permanent kind of outsider, the person who never quite, you know, identified with any group, is the sense of having been in a place where there was no one quite like me, ever. I mean, you know, I was just fate did that to me, kind of. In the suburbs, they're all alike, you know, and that's something that my wife Lee and I have in common, is that we're from towns so small that, you know, there was the classes were all melted together. I mean, we had friends with no teeth, you know, and it wasn't because we sought out the poor. It's they were there, you know, and people who came to class with their clothes spattered with manure, and it was something that we took for granted that there were people like that, and some of them were, you know, were interesting and some were not, but they were around us all the time. And I had this sense, this blue collar. My brother, incidentally, who's also, you know, very educated, who teaches English at Georgia Southern. My brother has this really powerful Bolshevik sense of belonging to the working class. Much stronger than mine. But you know, maybe William spoiled me a little bit. But the idea that I had is that I wanted to identify, to, you know, show solidarity, if you will. And it didn't quite work. I came from three or four generations of sedentary men who spent most of their time with books. And I went to work at the steel mill in Pittsburgh, and my mother's father was a steel salesman. He was in the steel business, and he had some connections, and he got me this really coveted job working in the cold roll mill. And the cold roll mill was a place where the temperature was only 125, you know, closer to the blast furnaces it was like 170. And I learned so quickly that I was not cut out, you know, to be a real John Henry, you know, a man, a kind of working man of the people. And it struck me right away that somehow or other I had to use what I had, which was, you know, but the ability to understand texts and express myself and so on, to make a living, because I wasn't going to be able to do it with my body. My temperament was all wrong. Not only that I was, you know, that I was a sissy in some ways, you know, but that my temperament was wrong.
Well, you seem always able or even eager to find aspects of the truths you discover and present in your writing, which manage to get everybody from every part of the political spectrum angry at one point or another.
Yeah, it's not being a contrarian. Of course, you know, the piece that, you know, that is running in Blackbird about Mencken, I think it's really important to, I mean, it struck me while I was reading about Mencken how people like Mencken, and I think like myself and a few others, come about. It's not because we're just contrarians, you know, just that we don't express an opinion only to shock or outrage or to offend people that we, you know, that we find amusing, their outrage amusing. We do it because we were raised to believe that you absolutely accept no authority except your own informed authority. I mean, that's the way I was raised, and it's clear that that's the way Mencken was raised. We're around these incredibly opinionated men, I mean, overbearing men, arrogant men, if you will. But instead, you can be crushed by those men. Now, there are sons in these families who don't end up saying, they end up saying nothing. Right, they end up working for big corporations and hanging their heads, and that's their life, and remembering the dad that shouted. But others, you know, who are really their father's children, who have the spark, they fight back. They fight back, and the only way you can fight back against a man, you know, who has read everything and is a master of rhetoric and speaks really well. My father was a historian and a lawyer, and you know, he just spoke really well. And the only way to fight back is to read, 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 think, and turn it all over and get your own ability to respond, you know. And I've been doing that all my life, in a sense. I've been kind of responding to my father. But the first thing that he taught me, you know, the valuable thing he taught me is accept no authority. He didn't say including mine, but, you know, that's what I added to it, sort of. And it's, I think it's the give and take. The fighting back against the authority figures in your own life that turn out somebody like that. But it's also, as I try to say in that essay, it's also the arrogance of people who are privileged to some extent. I mean, who have that middle class background in the sense that they can take the Promethean fire, you know, that they can reach up and take the torch, that they're not excluded from that, and that there's nobody particularly above you. I mean, the sense that I'm an outsider is very different from the person who thinks he's from the wrong side of the tracks and feels crushed by it and feels that everybody's putting him down and is defensive about it and so on. I was very much the opposite. I didn't think there was anyone on earth who was better than I was. I mean, that's the way I was raised. And, you know, and as I said, I came from some privilege and I was surrounded by books and so on. I didn't, no money really. I mean, just a certain privilege and a certain family tradition. And I never felt inferior to anybody. I mean, I'm one of those people who's shy by nature, but I'm never shy because the person next to me has some huge reputation or a lot of power or something. I mean, I respond exactly the same to the, you know, the president of U.S. Steel as I would to a shoeshine boy at Grand Central. I mean, I have the same manner with both of them, which I hope is a pleasant one. But I'm not cowed. And of course, Mencken was not cowed. And that is all, that's part of our class background. And it's also a part of this, you know, this tradition of disputatious men of the old school, kind of.
Well, that brings up something I've been thinking about in preparing for this interview. I was reading Matthew Arnold's preface to Culture and Anarchy the other day, and I ran across a passage which mentions that he was referred to as an elegant Jeremiah in the press. And that phrase put me in mind of you. Arnold wrote, "For this very indifference to political action, I have been taken to task by the Daily Telegraph, coupled by a strange perversity of fate with just that very one of the Hebrew prophets whose style I admire the least, and called an elegant Jeremiah." Arnold goes on to repeat that phrase several times, obviously relishing it. Then, after taking the English to task for their habitually dim view of curiosity, He goes on to explore the word's other more positive meanings in his first chapter titled Sweetness and Light. He writes, "Nay, and the very desire to see things as they are implies a balance and regulation of mind, which is not often attained without fruitful effort, and which is the very opposite of the blind and diseased impulse of mind, which is what we mean to blame curiosity." It strikes me that besides being an elegant Jeremiah, you also share with Arnold that balance and regulation of mind, that sort of curiosity that allows you and perhaps compels you to seek the truth, to follow that desire to see things as they are, no matter where that desire might take you.
Yeah, I'm against anyone who, you know, sort of abuses the truth or logic or language. I just think that's the reason, I guess, that I'm not politically predictable at all. Because, you know, people that I tend to agree with, people on the left, people with progressive political ideas and so on, they play the game too, you know. They construct false rhetoric. They make groups that all agree that they agree and use their political power, you know, by standing shoulder to shoulder, which is valuable in some ways. But in my field, I mean, I think I talk about that in one of the essays in my book, Cathedrals of Kudzu. I talk about you know, it's not worse than all the things we had before, you know, racism and misogyny and homophobia and so on. This new sort of political correctness, we all agree. But it's terrible for people who are in the business of communicating, because there's this constant, you know, sort of censor. And the censor is coming from your own friends and supposed allies. And I find myself fighting back against that sort of all my life. And one of the heroes, you can see from, there are a couple of essays in the book, I think, in Cathedrals of Kudzu that are really kind of show the way I think. And one of them is The Last Southern Hero, about Frank Johnson. Now, Frank Johnson was not a liberal. Frank Johnson was a Republican judge from North Alabama who detested Northerners trying to come down and you know, turn and civilize the South as much as he detested the Ku Klux Klan. Although, you know, he would have stood on the left because he was a man of principle. But he hated these people. And the important thing to Frank Johnson is that people behave decently, that they obey the law, and that, you know, then there was some sort of a civilized contract between people. And sometimes it took him, you know, on to the right, and sometimes it took him to the left. But he stood in the same place. And that's the kind of person that I've always admired, people like Mencken, like Frank Johnson, who don't want to march with this team or that army or this army, and who are absolutely determined to steer their own course. I consequently, you know, politically, sometimes I have no friends at all.